Support for this podcast comes from the Peabody Essex Museum, presenting Ethiopia at the Crossroads. On view now. Find out more about the exhibition at PEM.org.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, this is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. Critics have accused Nietzsche of providing few answers and contributing to nihilism. Robert Tulloch, one of the adolescent murderers of Dartmouth professors Hoff and Susanna Zontop, apparently saw himself as a kind of Nietzschean Superman, testing if he could kill without remorse. But then there's the alternate view that Nietzsche is not advocating meaninglessness but self-creation. How does this dangerous thinker resonate in today's world? Does he speak to you in his own voice or in that of his popularizer, Ayn Rand? Join the conversation at 1-800-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Joining me now from Washington is Peter Berkowitz. He's a law professor at George Mason University and the author of Nietzsche, The Ethics of an Immoralist. Peter, it's good to talk to you.
It's good to be here.
Peter, let's just... I'm going to read quotations, and I want you to sort of unpack them for us, but let's just set out the basic facts. This was a late 19th century German thinker who had rather a tough life, ill, neurasthenic, and ultimately a mental breakdown.
Quite right.
Yeah. And yet this man who knew every form of weakness was a kind of philosopher of strength, wasn't he?
Completely right, yes.
Yeah. Well, let me read this is from, I think, his first book, The Gay Science, one of his signature sort of utterances, and it's a it's from a section called The Madman, and he says, "Have you not heard of that madman who lit a lantern in the bright morning hours, ran to the marketplace and cried incessantly, 'I seek God, I seek God. Whither is God?' he cried. 'I shall tell you, we have killed him, you and I. All of us are his murderers. But how have we done this? How were we able to drink up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to wipe away the entire horizon? What did we do when we chained the earth from its sun? Whither is it moving now? Whither is it moving now, the world without God?'" Peter?
Well, one of the first things to understand about Nietzsche is his thinking is actually deeply infused by a religious sensibility. He was the son and the grandson of a Lutheran parson. And, excuse me, unlike so many of the professors that interpret Nietzsche today in the colleges and universities, Nietzsche saw the death of God not as a happy and liberating event, or at least not that in the first place, but as a kind of, as a catastrophe for the human spirit. Because God, religious belief was, in Nietzsche's view, the source of all that was strong, all that was beautiful, all that was elevating in human history. Nietzsche saw a moral obligation arising out of this death of God to indeed create for ourselves a new way of living, a new destiny, to create ourselves. Indeed, in this very same passage, Jack, from which you're reading, Gay Science 125, Nietzsche envisages as our duty arising out of our killing of God, the making of ourselves into gods. It's a dramatic and far-reaching conception.
The making of ourselves into gods. And how did he understand that we could do that? What did he mean?
Well, this has several components. In the first place, it means understanding our situation as it is. Excuse me. And I should say, in response to your opening, there are really many sides to Nietzsche. There are many Nietzsches, or as I prefer to say, many sides to the one and the same Nietzsche. There is the Nietzsche who is the kind of wicked, devastating critic of conventional morality and bourgeois culture. And this is the one that the youthful murderers in the 1920s, again in our own time, pick up on. There's Nietzsche who's the student of psychological depths. And there's Nietzsche who is a lover of truth. And it's that lover of truth who compels us to look at our situation as it truly is. And when we look at the situation as it truly is, Nietzsche says that which has oriented human beings, belief in something fine and high and noble that we human beings didn't make, that's an illusion, a noble illusion that we created. So what we must do, once having seen the situation as it truly is create some new ideal, something new and high.
And what did he expect that would be? I mean, he was a strong critic of democracy, which many people think is a kind of, well, certainly not secular equivalent of God, but about the best human beings can do.
Well, you're quite right. He was indeed a virulent critic of democracy. He laughed and mocked at the slogans that he associated with democracy, equality of rights and sympathy with all that suffers. This is from Beyond Good and Evil. So for Nietzsche, democracy was indeed a degradation. It put equality first rather than putting excellence first. Now, Nietzsche, throughout his career, Nietzsche considered and examined a variety of conceptions of human excellence, artistic excellence from the ancient Greeks, musical excellence, philosophical excellence, warrior excellence, too. My own view is that ultimately Nietzsche settles on a conception of human excellence very closely connected to Socrates, to the philosophical pursuit of truth, even ugly, dangerous truths, mm-hmm. of which Nietzsche spoke.
Mm-hmm. Now, his proclamation of the death of God was in the context of 19th century science, and more particularly the historical science of biblical scholarship, which sort of treated Jesus as a human being.
And, that's right.
And sort of pull the curtain away from some of the biblical truths. And of course, one of the reactions to that development, 19th century science, Darwinism, biblical scholarship, we're living with today, and that is fundamentalism as an impulse. Isn't that the impulse, the sort of counter nihilist impulse that the sort of the post God is dead world has sort of delivered to Nietzsche?
Well, I suppose in a sense it is, and there's some truth in the observation that fundamentalism is an invention of the modern world. Orthodoxy is an invention of the modern world. It's a response to the challenge, you could say of Nietzsche, but you could say more broadly, to the challenge of Enlightenment, which exposed or purported to expose the Bible, which had been treated as a book authored by God with roots in divinity, is actually a human work, all too human work. And fundamentalism has been a repudiation of that sometimes it's hard to say, premise or conclusion of Enlightenment thought. And fundamentalism has become defensive, it has hunkered down, and simply refused to listen to the counterclaims of science. It is indeed, as you say, a reaction to science and Enlightenment.
Mm. And not what Nietzsche thought was going to happen in the West after the age of science at all, right?
Well, it's interesting on this question. Nietzsche has various speculations about what may happen in the century that follows. For example, in Beyond Good and Evil, he envisaged something that he referred to as great politics, wars that would convulse the world. He hoped Europe would be at the center of this, creating a new kind of man. What that new kind of man consists in, what that politics looks like, we don't really know. But I wouldn't say mm-hmm. that this kind of an unthinking reaction to the challenge of science was beyond the ken of what Nietzsche imagined. Nietzsche had actually a very low opinion of the vast majority of mankind.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Did he have any sense of the Eastern world? We're living in a world of Muslim fundamentalism. We've just been talking about it. That seems to be one of the dominant realities of the day.
You know, the truth is that I believe that he had very little to say about Islam and the Arab world. As it happens, he talked often and admiringly about the Buddha and the form of life that the Buddha represented, a kind of cheerful distancing of the individual from suffering and not taking the world too seriously. To the extent that he speaks about Islam, he celebrates its warrior spirit.
Now, you mentioned his last book, Beyond Good and Evil, and in an article in the current Weekly Standard, a professor at the University of Virginia, James Caesar, he titles it Bush versus Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. And he says that George Bush, by bringing back the category, unequivocal category of evil, and speaking about things in those terms, is sort of repudiating the notion that we are beyond good and evil. In that sense, he's opposed to Nietzsche. Is George Bush sort of the anti-Nietzsche of our time?
Well, if you'll forgive me for being pedantic for just a moment, Professor Caesar makes an excellent point. But in point of fact, when Nietzsche says he envisages a world of beyond good and evil, he's quick to clarify what he means. He says he doesn't mean beyond good and bad. Without going into the details, Nietzsche was, contrary to a kind of popular representation of him, Nietzsche wasn't purely a champion of nihilism.
And can we define nihilism?
Yes. Nietzsche defines nihilism as the devaluation of the highest values. Say, there is no difference between right and wrong or good and bad, just and unjust, all in our imagination, or everything goes. Mm. Everything goes. Morality is a fiction. Mm-hmm. Now, for Nietzsche, beyond good and evil actually represented bourgeois or democratic morality. Mm. This he loathed to the core of his soul. So in some ways, actually, curiously, Bush actually represents the thing against which Nietzsche is indeed railing. That's true. Bush is really standing up for democratic bourgeois morality. Those who oppose it are our enemies. We can condemn them in a straightforward way.
Mm. And of course, when he was asked in a debate to name his favorite political philosopher, George W. Bush replied, "Christ, because he changed my heart."
And indeed, one could easily argue that Christ was Nietzsche's least favorite political philosopher.
And that because?
That's because in Nietzsche's view, actually, here I must once again, at the risk of being pedantic, distinguish. Nietzsche does sometimes offer admiring remarks about Jesus, but he did also loathe Christianity. The reason that he loathed Christianity is because he regarded it as a religion of weakness, as representing the revenge of the weak against the strong, the well-built, the healthy, the noble, the powerful. Christianity taught pity, compassion. It actually is a source of democratic morality in the sense that it stands for the equality of rights, the equality of all human beings in the presence of God, and sympathy for all that suffer. So democracy is a descendant in Nietzsche's views of Christianity, and he holds Christianity responsible.
Mm. So we're talking about the sort of the notion of Nietzsche as our contemporary. We see Bush as sort of the whole dialogue, the politics of evil, is clearly a sort of anti-Nietzsche rhetoric. And how else is—and use the word nihilism. We've heard that word again and again post-September 11th. How is that being used again in our new world?
Well, in a way, that particular usage has been around even before the terrible events of 9/11, especially in the academic culture. Nietzsche is celebrated as a champion of moral relativism. Once again, the view that everything goes, that there are no enduring universal standards, that morality is a matter of what you think or what I think. It is, in some ways, appropriate, but at a deeper level, ironic and wrong to see Nietzsche as the purveyor of this teaching. It's true, Nietzsche taught that God is dead, we killed him. He taught that there, in a famous formulation, there are no moral phenomena, only a moral interpretation of phenomena. Morality is only the interpretation we impose upon the world. He said, I think you mentioned this in the introduction, human conduct can be explained in terms of the will to power. It means that everything we seek and want and do, even if we present it as out of love and compassion or altruism, is an expression of our desire to manipulate, to control, and dominate. It's true, all of this is in Nietzsche, but also there are these other sides of Nietzsche. They're just as central. Nietzsche is a kind of exuberant, intrepid Socratic inquirer. Nietzsche is an astute student of our psychological depths. So I myself am reluctant to see Nietzsche as sort of the poster boy for that aspect of our age, which is nihilistic.
We'll be right back, Peter. We're talking about the philosophy of Friedrich Nietzsche. Does he best represent the prevailing philosophy of the post-9/11 world? What can we learn from him to help us through these times? Join the conversation by calling 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher whose name seems to be everywhere today, and most recently in an article called Bush versus Nietzsche. Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Peter Berkowitz, a philosopher at George Mason University, if I'm right. Peter, before the break, we had mentioned the we were talking about the influence of Nietzsche on young minds, and you mentioned Leopold and Loeb, and even one of the Dartmouth College murderers was imbued with Nietzschean notions. You characterize it, but here's the kind of passage that might well have inflamed such young people. See what you think. It's from fittingly, Beyond Good and Evil. Let's see if I can set it up. He says, he's talking about a world where people say, here we are all equal today. And he says, today, when only the herd animal is honored and dispenses honors in Europe, and when equality of rights could all too easily be converted into an equality in violating rights, by that I mean into a common war on all that is rare, strange, or privileged, on the higher man, the higher soul, the higher duty, the higher responsibility, and on the wealth of creative power and mastery, today the concept of greatness entails being noble, wanting to be by oneself, being capable of being different, standing alone, and having to live independently. And the philosopher will betray something of his own idea when he posits, he shall be the greatest who can be the loneliest, the most hidden, the most deviating, the human being beyond good and evil.
It's an extraordinary passage. There are many others throughout Nietzsche's writings which are of the same kind and equally extraordinary and riveting. And if you're a teenage boy, utterly captivating. I think it would go way too far to suggest that Nietzsche is somehow responsible for either the 1920s murders or those more recently, the Dartmouth College murders. We don't have... To assign responsibility, we would need for there to be more murders. But your choice of words is right. Nietzsche can inflame those passions that we associate with young men, a desire to be a part, a perception of the hypocrisy of the adult world, a desire to stand out oneself and to be great, to be noble, to do something for which you're recognized. But here's the crucial distinction, it seems to me. For what end the greatness? For what end undergoing the sacrifices? What is the point of the independence? And if one follows Nietzsche's thought out to the end, through his various books, the way he works out his ideas, one sees again and again that Nietzsche directs the violent rhetoric, the celebration of force and independence and crushing others. This is really in the end, ultimately, in the name of searching for and pursuing the truth wherever it may lead you. He takes the meaning of nobility, for example, from the same work you mentioned, Jack, Beyond Good and Evil, and he introduces it as it was understood often in the 19th century. Nobility was connected to bloodline and caste, your position in society that was fixed at birth. Nietzsche transforms the meaning of this conception of nobility to mean a certain kind of soul which would not think of imposing its own duties on others as duties for them, and these duties have to do with living an upright life which is always revolves around the pursuit of truth. This in no way is to deny the inflammatoriness of of the rhetoric that runs all the way through his writings.
Let's bring in Richard Schacht. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois at Champaign-Urbana and the executive director of the North American Nietzsche Society. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Have you been listening to our conversation here?
Yes, I have.
Can you put some of this in the context of this man's life? I just read, for example, a review in The New Yorker that had this man who scorned altruism and who had such contempt for Christian morality that the precipitating incident that led to his final incapacitation and madness that did this was an incident of rushing out in the street to prevent someone from whipping a horse.
Well, Nietzsche was not by any means someone indifferent to suffering. In fact, I think that you would be hard put to find anyone in the history of philosophy or of any other kind of intellectual or creative endeavor who had to deal with as difficult a time as Nietzsche did in terms of his physical infirmities. And for Nietzsche, it was tremendously important not to give in to these things, not to let them defeat you, to be able to rise above the problems that beset you in order to still carry on with life instead of becoming embittered and withdrawn and throwing in the towel. Nietzsche believed beyond all else in the attainment of human excellence in many different forms, and he had nothing but contempt for those who did not have the courage and ability to fight through their problems, as he certainly had in his own case, in order to try to make something of themselves in their lives. And so even to the very end, when he was losing it, when he was quite capable of compassion for suffering, but suffering was not the most important thing about life for Nietzsche. That was what Schopenhauer thought, and that was what Nietzsche thought was very short-sighted.
What was the point of life then?
The point of life for Nietzsche is much better expressed by the idea of creativity. It seemed to Nietzsche that the only way to make life worth living and worthwhile was to turn it into something that was more than just another dumb piece of natural phenomena on a little bitty planet out at the edge of a solar system. For Nietzsche, what mattered about us was that we, uniquely among the forms of life on this planet, have the ability to rise above the merely natural and make something creative of ourselves. And he wanted to do everything he could to get people to focus on that possibility, instead of either lamenting our suffering or bemoaning the fact that our life is not eternal.
And just to give us the short course, from what did he suffer?
Well, he had many afflictions. Even as a younger person, he was his eyes were terrible. He had migraine headaches. His digestive system was very bad. In his young adult life, he was a medic in the Franco-Prussian War and picked up a number of illnesses from the wounded he was tending, and that just made things worse. And then he probably wound up contracting syphilis in some form or another, which may well have been what precipitated his madness in the end. So he was dealing with physical afflictions from the time he was a relatively young man on. He had a relatively powerful constitution earlier, which enabled him to surmount this for a fair while, but after a while, it was sheer willpower that kept him going.
And how he spent a long time basically mad, 10 or more years.
Yes, well, his life more or less came to an end with his collapse in January of 1889, and for the next 10 years, he was not himself anymore. He was the Friedrich Nietzsche who mattered was no longer there. So you just have to forget about those 10 years. He might as well have been dead.
And how did he live them?
He was under the care of his mother and then of his sister and mother and then of his sister. But it's a very sad chapter of his life, and it's not a part of his life that it really helps us to spend our time on.
Mm. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Eugene is on the line. Welcome.
Yes, I would like to make a comment on President Bush's life.
Yes.
In the context of perhaps creativity and overcoming his maybe not very bright academic achievements.
Mm-hmm.
So in this description, Bush fits very well into some sort of a prince who has certain self-realization coming from very good bloods and parents, mm-hmm. from Nietzsche's point of view, and when he assumes certain values of the herds and proclaims this, as any other politician would do, he certainly is not necessarily believes them. He acts quite differently in his career and his moving up very quickly and becoming a president. So he could be quite easily described as hero in Nietzsche terms.
Hero in Nietzsche terms. Peter Berkowitz.
I must say, in Nietzsche's terms, I suspect it's an exaggeration to regard Bush in terms of his rise from poor academic achiever to United States president as a Nietzschean hero. Now, it is true that Nietzsche, throughout his writings, praises various political figures. They tend to be warlike figures, Alcibiades, Julius Caesar, and others. And what he admires in these political figures is a certain ruthlessness, mm-hmm. a willingness to sacrifice life for political ends, an unwillingness to be bound down by conventional morality. Bush, I actually see as a champion of conventional morality. Mm-hmm. And in this respect, I would say actually anti-Nietzschean.
Although he's a man who struggled with a real emotional, physical problem, alcohol, and his religious experience.
That's not true, actually.
Oh,
Nietzsche was actually
I'm talking about Bush.
Ah.
Yeah, that Bush actually had a lot of struggle in his life, and that his religious conversion, as it were, was the thing that saved him.
Well, the question is, I suppose, how far we want to stretch Nietzsche's notion of overcoming,
mm-hmm.
And how technically we want to understand the notion that Professor Schacht mentioned of creating oneself, refashioning oneself anew. I suppose we could include it. We could expand it to include overcoming the kinds of challenges and disabilities that we face mm-hmm. in everyday life. Mm-hmm. And I suppose that's part of it. But Nietzsche, I do think, generally and for the most part, had something quite grand in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And we bring Nietzsche down. The risk is that we bring Nietzsche down to earth and turn him into something he really is not quite. We turn him into a pop psychology guru.
Professor Schacht?
Yes, I think that it is. I'm sorry, were you about to ask me a question?
No, I'm just asking your response.
I don't think that Bush is a very good example of a Nietzschean higher type. it is perhaps true that he overcame certain personal difficulties, but he is fundamentally an advocate and spokesperson for what Nietzsche would call herd values rather than the kinds of values that Nietzsche thought it was very important to be accentuated and developed. Nietzsche was an apostle of creativity and excellence in areas of human achievement, whether they're artistic or scientific or athletic or any of the areas in which human beings can take their natural abilities and turn them into something admirable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the extent to which one has to break free from conventional expectations is a measure of the extent to which one is capable of being a higher type of human being.
Mm. And
I don't think that Nietzsche would see Bush is a very good example of that sort of thing.
All right. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mike is on the line. Welcome, and thank you for your patience.
Well, thank you. I'd just like to comment on Nietzsche, and it seemed that earlier in your conversation you were almost looking to see if Nietzsche had a place in the current philosophic lexicon. And it almost seemed to me that the danger is that once you let Nietzsche out of the bottle, that it becomes an almost uncontainable sort of phenomenon. And it almost seems like, you know, after over 100 years since Nietzsche's death, that he's still an uncontrollable thinker, and that for his arguments, you can't really find counter arguments that can actually, you know, sort of neutralize them. And it almost seems as if the appeal there is that Nietzsche talks to the almost infantile need within all of us to have power, and therefore can't be controlled.
Peter Berkowitz?
Nietzsche himself described his own philosophy as a kind of dynamite. I think that's right. He talks about heights. He talks about depths. He urges us to the most extraordinary sorts of achievements. And by the way, I should say, while I agree with Professor Schack that Nietzsche is not a, sorry, Bush is not a Nietzschean hero, it might well be that what we don't want in the office of the president right now, a Nietzschean hero. We want someone who is capable, in good old-fashioned bourgeois terms, of recognizing the difference between good and evil. As far as the idea that what Nietzsche appeals to is something infantile in us, I do believe it's true. I believe Nietzsche would recognize it. I believe he recognizes, in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, that there is an infantile, but there is also a mature and elevated longing for mastery. He repudiates the infantile search for control and manipulation, but the mature form of mastery that he envisages quite breathtakingly in various works, especially Thus Spoke Zarathustra, nevertheless, in his own view, are extremely dangerous, fit only for the few, and represent an undertaking that of necessity pushes you beyond the boundaries of conventional morality. So in that respect, I certainly agree with the caller. Yes, Nietzsche understood his philosophy to be extremely dangerous, and it is extremely dangerous.
As you were describing that that character type, it sounded almost like Osama bin Laden.
Well, to some extent, it's not a question that we've yet been posed. It's a provocative one. Maybe what would Nietzsche have thought of Osama bin Laden? And here we tread upon some very delicate questions with regard to Nietzsche. But as Professor Schacht also mentioned, Nietzsche loathed herd morality. That's democratic morality. That's our morality that supposes the freedom and equality of all individuals. That Nietzsche often is in his writings, however compassionate he may have been personally, in his writings he often encourages the idea that human life, the life of the multitude, is cheap, especially in the name of great politics, grand undertakings. That having been said, that Nietzsche encourages that way of thinking, I don't doubt that Nietzsche in the end would have reviled Osama bin Laden, because again, in the end, the greatest undertakings that Nietzsche understood were the undertakings of creative individuals, especially in the realm of arts and philosophical inquiry.
And we want to get back to that, his interest in the arts, and especially in the art of Richard Wagner. We're talking about a thinker who had dynamite in his thought. We're at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point. We're talking about Friedrich Nietzsche, our contemporary this hour, with two scholars of his thought. And I want to get to a caller in a minute who raises a question about the Nietzschean Superman. But that raises a prior question for you, Richard Schacht, and that is, Thomas Mann said it was the clumsiest of all misunderstandings that the work of this politically naive and wholly spiritual figure, Nietzsche, should somehow have justified the Nazi assault on civilization. What's your comment to that?
I certainly think that's right. It didn't justify it. It was used to justify it, but it was used in a ridiculous, caricatured form. Nietzsche would have despised the Nazis and everything they stood for and everything they did. For him, the travesty of the Nazis was to subordinate every cultural and spiritual value to the most lamentable and appalling of forms of the will to power. He may have thought that everything in life is understandable in terms of the will to power, but there were some expressions of it that were awful, and there were some expressions of it that were admirable. And he would have thought the Nazis were on the far end of the awful side.
The will to power. This was a man who didn't know much about love.
Well, I think that he thought he knew a good bit about it, although he knew more about it by imagining it than actually experiencing it. But he did think that both the kinds of close bonds between human beings that are humanly possible and the kind of love that is expressed in the pursuit of artistic and scientific and other forms of human excellence are the most important things about us. Mm. Love for Nietzsche was the sublimest expression of a will to power that is nothing to be ashamed of.
Mm. Raza is on the line. Hello, and thanks so much for waiting.
Hi, Jack. How are you?
Well, we're fine.
Thank you very much for the interesting program. You're doing a great job in absence of time.
Well, thank you, and I hate to rush you, but if you could
sure.
be brief.
I would like to get a view of your panel on the subject of Übermensch.
Übermensch.
Yes. Overman, sometimes it's been translated Superman.
Okay. Who was the Nietzschean Superman? Peter Berkowitz?
The Superman is not exactly the hero of Thus Spoke Zarathustra. I suppose Zarathustra is the hero. Zarathustra teaches the Superman, so the question arises, a question Jack asked earlier, what is the content of the Superman's life? And what we see unfolding in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, at least as I read it, is that the Superman, standing for the supreme form of human excellence, is a creature who must slowly, slowly, a man, slowly, slowly shed every kind of human attachment and commitment in the interest of this thing we've been referring to as self-making, self-creating. It's a devastating undertaking that Zarathustra, who takes this challenge upon himself, can barely and effectively survive. It's a kind of mastery that comes through understanding truly the character of the world and living in accordance with the ugly truths that one finds out about the sources or lack of sources for morality.
Richard Chalk, you want to add something to that?
Yes, I would. To me, the idea of the Übermensch is not the name of some bunch of people that are going to come walking down the street someday.
Mm-hmm.
The Übermensch is a symbol for the enhancement of life, the transformation of the merely natural into the creative. The higher humanity that the Übermensch helps us to orient toward can take many different forms. But what the Übermensch is supposed to keep us focused on is the idea of turning our otherwise meaningless lives into something admirable through their creative refinement and the exercise. So I do not see the notion of the Übermensch as a threatening or scary notion at all, but rather as the transcendence of the all-too-human.
The all-too-human, a Nietzschean phrase.
And the accentuation of a human creative ability in all of the different possible ways that we have it in us to achieve.
Thank you.
It is a tremendously affirmative image.
Thank you, Richard Chalk. He's a professor of philosophy at the University of Illinois and the executive director of the North American Nietzsche Society. And thank you, Peter Berkowitz, law professor at George Mason University and author of Nietzsche, The Ethics of an Immoralist. You can read Beyond Good and Evil on our website. Log on to onpointradio.org. In a moment, our movie expert looks at Nietzsche's themes in film. This is On Point. The influence of Nietzsche's writings on Robert Tulloch, one of the two Vermont teenagers just convicted in the murder of two Dartmouth professors, eerily rings back 76 years to a case that riveted a nation. In 1924, Nathan Leopold, imbued with Nietzschean ideas, and Richard Loeb, two precocious and well-to-do teenagers, murdered a 14-year-old boy strictly to see if they could get away with it. the trial, which featured a legendary 12-hour-long plea by defense lawyer Clarence Darrow to save their lives, was world-famous. To see how Hollywood has portrayed the story of Leopold and Loeb, we're joined by our on-point movie maven, Garen Daly. Welcome, Garen.
Hi, Jack. How you doing?
Well, I'm doing fine. This case has been in how many movies?
It's been in about four. The first really good one, I think, was Rope, directed by Alfred Hitchcock, where Hitchcock has taken the Loeb-Leopold story and put it in one set inside a penthouse where the character of Loeb and Leopold, who are played by Farley Granger and John Dahl, have invited all their friends over after they've murdered a guy and put him in a chest, and they're going to have dinner with the food on top and the body inside the chest. And one of the people they invited over is Jimmy Stewart, their old headmaster from their prep school, who espoused a Nietzschean kind of philosophy. And these two guys have taken it to heart and are now trying to fulfill on that philosophy by their action.
The malign power of ideas.
Well, that may be, but the fact of the matter is it makes great story.
Let's hear the clip.
Now, mind you, I don't hold with the extremists who feel that there should be open season for murder all year round. No. Personally, I would prefer to have cut a throat week or strangulation day.
Probably a symptom of approaching senility, but I must confess I really don't appreciate this morbid humor.
Well, the humor was unintentional.
But you're not serious about these theories.
Of course he is.
Oh, you're both pulling my leg.
No, why do you think that?
Well, Brandon, the notion that murder is an art which a few superior beings should be allowed to practice.
In season.
Now, I know you're not serious.
But I am. I'm a very serious fellow.
Then may I ask, who is to decide that a human being is inferior and is therefore a suitable victim for murder?
The few who are privileged to commit murder.
What I love about what Hitchcock has done here is he's taken these two guys and he's put them in a very upper-class situation. They're incredibly privileged, just like Loeb and Leopold were. They are very narcissistic, and not narcissistic in the fact of they love the way they look, but more that they're the center of the universe. And they're amoral or immoral. And we are fascinated that all this wealth and privilege is wasted on these amoral, immoral people.
Yeah, and part of the dramatic irony of that scene is that the man with the British accent, Sir Cedric Hardwicke, is the father of the boy who's dead inside the chest.
Yeah, it's one of the little games that the John Dahl character is playing. Now, another interesting aspect about the relationship between the two boys or the two men in this and in the subsequent films is that they have an inferiority complex with each other. One thinks the other is smarter, or the other one thinks the other one is better looking or more socially graceful.
Mm. Let's have the next one.
Well, the next one is Compulsion, which is based on the Meyer Levin play, which is, again, based on the Loeb-Leopold thing. And it is now the point where, you know, it's early on in their relationship. They are slowly moving up the ladder of crime as they bond together by committing these crimes, much like Tulloch and Parker did, where they did some breaking and entering first. In this particular case, the Loeb-Leopold characters are deciding to move to the next step.
I want to do something really dangerous. Something that'll have everybody talking, not just a few guys.
With half the fat-headed cops in Chicago running around in circles wondering about it while we sat back and laughed at them, huh?
Yes, but together, Artie. Something perfect. Something brilliant. The true test of the superior intellect, with every little detail worked out.
And dangerous, really dangerous. That's the only way it'd be any fun.
Yes.
You'd get panicky again.
No, I wouldn't. It must be done as an experiment. Detached, with no emotional involvement. And no reason for it except to show that we can do it.
We can do it.
That was a scene from Compulsion, a 1959 film that starred Orson Welles as Clarence Darrow.
Yes, and the two young guys were Bradford Dillman and Dean Stockwell very early on in their career, and they do a very nice job with what they had to work with there. Mm. But what I like, again, is that they're escalating their courtship.
Yes.
You know, they're getting closer to each other, and they're moving their, you know, their homoerotic love affair, which is very subdued in these films because, again, it's in the 50s, but they're doing it, they're making a vow to each other. And as they get closer and closer to the ultimate expression being a murder, which will bond them together. That is going to be the ritual that bonds them together, in a sense, marries them together. Mm-hmm. And in the new film, Murder by Numbers, what happens is that they commit the murder, and one of the boys is very, very, very smart, and he knows exactly what he's doing, and he's studied all the books, and he's going to send the police on a wild goose chase. As they track one lead, he's going to be mocking them the entire time.
Let's hear it.
A few common yellow carpet fibers, some red carpet fibers, and some hair. That's it.
Yellow carpet fibers consistent with a mass-produced line of the triacetate variety manufactured out of Denver, distributed all over the western United States under several different brand names. No help.
Microscopic examination of the cuticle, the cortex, and the medulla of the hair will reveal them to be human in origin. All but one. This one will baffle them, but it will all make sense later.
With hair of non-human origin, scale pattern of the hair matches that of Sinocephalus maimon. It's a freaking baboon hair.
These two guys, mm-hmm. Ryan Gosling and Michael Pitt as the killers, are just incredible. It makes them film really click. Mm. They're very, very good.
Mm-hmm. Now, the relationship between these two young men becomes charged erotically in the next film you want to quote for us, Swoon.
Swoon, which came out a couple of years ago. But this is a homosexual variation on the Loeb-Leopold paradigm. Mm-hmm. And they've done a job where they have really made them lovers. Mm-hmm. These guys are lovers. When they kill Bobby Franks, and it's based on Loeb-Leopold, when they kill Bobby Franks, they actually kiss during the burial of him. It's how, again, that part of that ritual and the bonding. However, what happens in all of these films is something goes wrong. Mm-hmm. One little thing happens, and the detectives find it. In Tulloch and Parker, it was the knife sheaths that they left behind. In the Loeb-Leopold actual thing, it was the glasses that left behind. And in Murder by Numbers, there's some vomit that leads to the clue. But what happens is the bonds between the two guys after the ritual begin to break down mm-hmm. because doubt is now put in its place.
Let's hear it from Swoon.
They can find us because you lost your glasses.
No. No way. They're common. The frame, the prescription. I mean, if you think I should go to the police and claim them, it's fine. I have the perfect alibi. I took my burning class there Monday.
No. I just got excited. Put it in the box. No one will recognize it now.
There's also that rug in the trunk. Go for a drive?
One condition. I drive.
Fine. Great, just don't kill me.
What was it that trips these two up?
Well, this is based on the Loeb-Leopold, and what tripped them up were the glasses. And they were right that there were like something like 4,000 people with that same prescription, the same horn rims. But the wedges or the hinges on the glasses, there were only three people in Chicago, and one of them was out of the country at the time, and the other one was not an appropriate candidate. It was Loeb, who was the appropriate candidate for that.
Whatever became of these two men?
Well, what happened was is that Loeb, they both got convicted, and Clarence Darrow did that wonderful defense for against capital punishment, and they were both convicted for life imprisonment. Leopold ended up serving most of his sentence and got out in the mid-50s and went to Puerto Rico and did some teaching and did work with ornithology. Loeb was murdered in prison in 1936. According to what happened was he was in a shower with another inmate, and the inmate says that Loeb propositioned him, and then he stabbed him 56 times. But at one of his obituaries, Ed Leahy of the Chicago Daily News in 1936 said, "Richard Loeb, despite his erudition, today ended his sentence with a proposition."
Garen Daly is the owner of the Dedham Community Theater in Dedham, Massachusetts, and On Point's movie maven. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Tim Skog, and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Jack Beatty. This is On Point.
This is WB.